Hey, and welcome to Back Issues, the comic podcast so old we were there when Captain America punched Hitler in the face.
Yeah. Oh yeah, man.
I'm your host, Jason, and with me we got Daryl.
Yo.
Wayne.
Yo ho.
Dick.
Yeah.
And our special guest, Mike.
Hello.
Alright, this week we had to read Art Spiegelman's Mouse. It's a really interesting piece. I first read it when I was about 18 or so. It deals with the artist, Art Spiegelman, doing a series of interviews with his father about, you know, both the Polish experience in the 30s, 40s in Poland and surrounding interesting areas like Auschwitz and Birkenau. Very dark and personal story, really. It was no joke, it was a hard read.
Very hard read, but also really fascinating too, man. Because there's a lot of stuff that takes place in the then present time when he's interviewing his father that mm-hmm. kind of humanizes him a lot more than even, you know, the past stuff itself did, you know?
Well, Spiegelman was smart. He included enough quote-unquote modern day talk with his father, enough to give his father a very deep and rich personality.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't come across as just a narrator. He comes across as, you know, a person who has a story that's worth more than, you know, anything else he has.
Right. And you can really see how, like, the war shaped his character and everything as well from what's going on based on what's going on as well. Art's really good at mm-hmm. tying those two in together. I have a mm-hmm. feeling he played a little bit artistically with the timeline of events somewhat to make it so that way he could, you know, line things up a little bit better for storytelling wise. But it definitely shows in the modern day cutaways, like, very relevant, you know, behavioral tics and things that he's picked up from, you know, like the one of the main things throughout the whole thing is that he saves everything, you know.
Yeah,
and
there's
it shows
one scene that sticks out to me. Art takes a match to light his cigarette, and his father Vladek goes nuts. He's like, you know, I need those. What am I going to do if I don't have one? And it's like almost a hoarding mentality,
right?
I mean, normally you'd push such thing off as a generic old Jewish stereotype, you know?
Unfortunately, in order to get anything in the camps, you had to have to scrimp and save and basically hoard literally everything you can. Everything became an item for barter. Matches.
There's actually a scene that goes into that, Mike,
mm-hmm.
where they tell the exchange rates. It's like one day's ration of bread is worth 3 cigarettes. 200 cigarettes is a bottle. I think it was gin or vodka. I forget which.
Yeah, it was vodka.
Vodka. You know, and having to work these exchange rates on a cigarette-based economy. Because the only thing that was worth anything was cigarette and food.
So it's kind of like they do in, a like, prisons now.
I was going
to
say, it
sounded to an extreme,
like,
yeah.
Sounded like the time I spent in prison, for sure. Nah.
This is why we keep
that's
Darryl
why
around.
I was comfortable laughing. I knew he was joking.
Yeah.
Daryl went to prison for being Daryl.
Yeah,
it's a capital crime these parts.
By death, actually,
he was there. He was only there for a day. They realized it was a misfiling and paperwork and stuff.
Daryl.
Yeah, you're supposed to. No, you're supposed to get a ticket for jaywalking. They trumped up the charges.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to Mouse. The really interesting thing is, I know you had a problem with it, Dick, but the art style.
It's not so much that I have a problem with it. I just don't like it. It's too
muddy.
Yeah, muddy is a good word for it. It's very rough. I mean, I understand why he did it, and it's a very smart move on Art's part to really, like, show you this is a gritty story. This isn't happy-go-lucky. This isn't, you know, Teen Titans or something, or,
yeah.
You know, this is a very real, this happened sort of a thing. Well, it's almost as if the art is there to kind of be like, hey, it's a comic book.
Well,
it's also the fact that the art style is kind of reminiscent of the time he was, you know, drawing it, is because this was Yeah, Jason, you know, he'll know exactly what I'm talking about. This was indie before indie.
Yep.
Right.
This was indie when indie, you had to know a guy.
Yeah, you had to know a guy just to get, like, I mean, the, you know, I went and did the read the background on this too, you know, just so I'd have all the, you know, pertinent information, not just the story, but also how what it went into it. They published it out of Raw Mag, you know, it was Raw Magazine. It was a magazine they published, him and his wife published.
And it and was serialized over, like, over a decade.
Yeah, it was, like, from 1980 until 1991.
Yeah.
So, this was a long, I think in 92 is when the graphic came out.
It was heavy metal before there was even the concept of heavy metal. This was very, very, very raw comic.
Yeah, and if I remember my comic history, Raw came more out of the 70s underground, like the Zap Collective kind of ideas.
Yeah, because yeah, that's one of the things I was reading up on. What they called it, the underground comics with an X.
Yep.
Yeah,
and I love those things. I will fully admit.
I mean, and you look at some of the, I'm just looking over some because I read up a little bit on Raw too. That it was basically that kind of stuff. You know, like for example, I mean, obviously you can't see it, but looking at the first issue, and it's basically that same kind of style. You know. Mm-hmm. Little minimalistic and things like that.
There's a part in Mouse where they reprint one of Art Spiegelman's earlier works that was dealt with the suicide of his mother.
Right.
And that was a reprint from Raw, if I remember correctly.
It was, yes.
And it was very 70s underground comics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'm looking at Art's art outside of the, you know, Mouse kind of, you know, context. And he's a very capable artist, so It's kind of easy to assume that Mouse was a very stylistic choice too, you know.
Yeah.
I think the point was that it was supposed to be less about the art and more about the story.
Right.
See, the art was just in the service of the story.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed about the I remember from the story itself is that the artist said that his father made him slightly neurotic. Because his father was always better at him at handyman things, like making things by hand, and being an artist was one place where he could be better than his father. The way I see it, this way this art style is, he's basically humbling himself in order to pay homage to his father's experiences.
Right. To put the focus more on his father's story than the art.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's very effective, I think. There's a particular panel, you know, where Art's kind of at his drawing board working on the book. And, you know, it's just him at his art desk, and he's talking about how, you know, it's how he's expecting a baby and all that.
And his father just died, yeah.
Right. And then you see in the third panel, it's three panels. In the third panel, there's a pile of dead bodies, you know, and it's very, very effective, you know, because he's
You gotta imagine that a piece like this, even in creating it and not being personally involved in things like the Holocaust, just knowing that's part of your family history, that's gotta put a lot of weight on you.
Oh, for sure.
Definitely.
Sure, and you know, it's like you were, you know, like you guys were saying earlier, those little ticks that his dad carried over from his experience, you know, in Auschwitz and stuff, you know, that kind of, I think, defined Art's, you know, life too, because, you know, even though he wasn't there, you know, himself, you know, he did experience kind of the effect that it had on his dad, you know, which I'm sure informed how his dad raised his kids, you know? So, you know, I think this was, you know...
Not to mention his brother who had died, not in the camps, but in the things that led up to the camps.
Yeah, it was led up to the camps. Yeah, because the Gestapo was coming for all the Jews, essentially. And that's when the aunt that was taking care of the child at the time, his brother that he never met, obviously.
Now, I want to bring up the biggest stylistic choice of this comic, and that's making everybody animals.
Right.
Like, you never see a human face except for in that reprint.
Right.
Everybody is either, like, a mouse, a cat, there's, you know, pigs. but they're not divided by people are a certain animal. It's where your ethnicity makes you an animal.
Right. The Jews mice are the all Jews. Mice. Yeah, the Germans are cats.
Yep. Yeah, the Polish people are pigs. Yep.
I linked the original art style too. It's interesting that the graphical release is a lot more simple than one of the original runs of this.
Oh yeah, the original runs were very reminiscent of that 70s underground comic style. But it made it a little too cartoony.
Right.
It lacked that edge. It lacked that feel of downtroddenness that the more sketchy art style gave it.
I have to agree, definitely. I think that it definitely was it. What's the word I'm looking here for? It definitely it's not just a stylistic choice. It does the whole story and the arc and everything justice. It's the only way to present it correctly. Because when I'm looking at that original art, it definitely feels like like deviant art sort of.
Actually, like, what it feels to me more like is Fritz the Cat.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Like, but it kind of takes the story though and tumblerizes it in my eyes ish.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't like about it. It with the original art, it definitely the simplistic style was a good choice.
And it's telling a raw tale with raw art, you know. It's not, you know, like we said earlier, it's kind of, you know, focusing less on the art style and more on just telling this very personal story.
There's a visual gag in this panel that sadly our listeners cannot see, but it's too cartoony and really looks like a forced blowjob metaphor.
Right.
Which does not work with how heavy-handed the real issue, the real story was. That kind of visual gag just does not fit.
Right.
Whereas these desiccated, haunted-looking, almost juvenilely drawn mice somehow bring the whole point home with a bigger hit. I mean, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely. It's, but, yeah, the pacing is another thing that I really want to talk about with this, is it, it really, what's the word I'm looking for? It lends itself well to being a comic book. It flows really well, and you can definitely see how it was broken up to be serialized and everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it still flows really well as a full novel.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even notice. Like, you can tell where it was split for serialization very easily, very well-designed chapters to this. And then having to split it across two books. But at the same time, if you read it all straight through, it just feels like one constant piece. With just a little bit in the middle where he kind of does a flash forward, you know?
Yeah.
And says, this is what's changed. My father's dead. I have a kid, you know? But other than that, it's very linear for a story told in flashbacks, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting how he manages to get the whole story to march along and be structured the way it is. And it carries itself really well without feeling almost as if everything is rushed through, you know? Like, everything is condensed in a way that you get everything that you need that's important without it being, you know, too much detail. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Now, what's really interesting, to go back to the art style, Daryl, I know you know Garbage Pail Kids.
Oh, yeah.
And you know that Art Spiegelman did some of the work on them.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, I've got the book
it's
around here somewhere that has all the cards.
Yep.
In it, yeah.
So it's evident that Spiegelman does have a definitive style that is production level.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And to take that step back for this and draw something a little more visceral with rough edges. I think was far smarter of a plan than.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I said earlier, I think it takes the emphasis off the artwork and puts it where it needs to be.
But, and to go along with that, I really want to stress out, like, I feel that having each race or ethnicity portrayed by a different animal evokes feelings of stuff like Animal Farm, but still gives it a very unified feel. All of the Jews are one animal. You know, they're all mice.
And it does, I think it also is really effective, like like you're saying, like, you know, every kind of like nationality or race or whatever is its own animal, so it gives you really easy shorthand to determine who's who,
uh-huh,
and what's what, you know, and
you don't have to spend as much time with exposition.
Right.
And can I just point out that it's kind of funny that the Frenchman is a frog?
Well, yes, there is some stereotyping going on.
Yeah.
But I gotta admit, it was genius having the Jews be mice and the Germans be their natural enemy, the cat.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, it's like...
One thing I extra like about this is that the no matter how unified the animals may seem, they're always, always seem to be either out for themselves or out for their families. But it always varies. It's always different. It's just they're people first and foremost.
With the exception of the Germans, they do come across as sadistic bastards.
There was this one, but there was that one scene where, you know, where it was talking about a quote Jewish prisoner, and in one panel, you know, it's showing him as a mouse, right? And he says, you know, but I'm German. And the question was asked, is like, well, was he a German? Yes, but he was a prisoner in the camp. So to all the Germans, he was a Jew.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So in the next panel, it showed him as a cat.
Yep.
So basically, it wasn't, you know, it was, you know, the metaphor is like, when you're a prisoner, you know, in that regard, you're all the same.
Yep.
So
unless you're a capo. Because they did show them as pigs and other animals.
Right, right. The ones who kind of ran things.
Almost like an overboss.
Yeah, they called them trustees in here in America. That's kind of, you know,
and
like...
See,
Wayne,
that was a really good observation, man, because, you know, it occurs to me that that's a really effective way of you know, showing kind of the perception, the character's perceptions and shit in a very simplistic way without beating you over the head with it, you know?
Right. That, I mean, because anybody could probably say I was German, but he actually was a German. But,
right,
but to the people who are imprisoning you, you're all scum,
right?
You know, so
you're all mice,
right? And like you said, you had the situation where, you know, you had the pigs, which are Polacks, you know, ethnic Polacks, who are just going along with what the Germans wanted them to do. So that's why they saw them as pigs, because, like, oh, you know, they're traitors to them, you know,
saying?
So, and now the other interesting part is along the idea with the traitors.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the Jews that turned on their own people, they were still done up as mice.
Hmm.
Kind of saying, even though they betrayed us, they can't betray their blood.
Right.
I also liked how when he was pretending to be a Pole or something like that, he had a mask on. Yeah, that was very interesting, and I really liked that because it was, you know... It's a good metaphor to show, like, hey, this is a paper thin veneer. You know, eventually they're gonna figure out I'm a Jew if I draw too much attention. You know, kind of a thing. And it was very interesting to show that, like, no matter how safe you think you are, you're not really safe. You know.
And what's even more interesting, on the same note, is the points where Art does draw real people, they still have the mask on.
Right.
Kind of
right.
Saying we are real people, we are individuals, but at the same time, we wear our identity on our sleeve.
Well, like when he portrays himself, always wearing a mouse mask.
Mm-hmm. And when he portrays his shrink.
Right, right. Interesting stuff. It's really effective, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's genius how this thing was really put together.
Which is crazy, because, like, to hear it, Art was very neurotic. And always kind of worrying about how, like, that aforementioned portrayal of the German character as a mouse in the, and, you know, back and forth in those panels, that was apparently a very big point of contention for him. So, you know, that he managed to do this and pull it off so well is just a testament to his talent, I think. You know, it all came together.
He is an extremely talented man.
But it all came together in a way that really kind of, begets the this kind of discussion, you know. And whether intentionally or not, you know, that's an accomplishment, you know.
But now let's get to the real meat of the situation. This is a story not just about the Holocaust, but the events leading up to the Holocaust. We're talking the entire run from when it first hits Poland to when the U.S. troops set them free. And even after, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What's really interesting to see is how he simply lays bare the racism involved. Even when he sits there and when, like, the Polish people start turning against the Jews, it's laid completely bare. There's no buffering, you know?
Mm-hmm. He doesn't even shy away from his dad's prejudices.
Oh, yeah, when they pick up the black hitchhiker.
Right.
And he's sitting there called Schwarzer or something like that. I don't speak Yiddish.
Right.
It was really interesting how he just kind of just, you know, was just like, this happened, you know. Yep. He didn't try to sugarcoat it. He didn't try to hide it. He was just like very upfront.
He's just like, hey, check it out. My dad's a casual racist.
Well, he didn't romanticize any of it. But, you know, here's the facts as they stand, or at least as my dad is telling me. And, you know, and presenting that story to the reader, trusting the reader to know what to make of it, you know. I think that's a talent that we could use a hell of a lot more of in the industry today. The ability to tell a story and trust that your audience will understand where you're going with that kind of respect.
Yeah.
Back then you did, and it was fascinating because his dad, you know, even as a persecuted Jew, had his prejudices still, you know. So it's kind of interesting to see that in play.
And it's really interesting seeing how he treats his dad both as, you know, the man who survived against incredible odds, but at the same time, he's neurotic, he's racist. He's in a marriage to a woman that he hates.
Right.
I mean, and it's obviously mutual enough that she left his ass. And it's just interesting to see how he paints his father, not with, you know, broad strokes, but with delicate little lines that shows exactly the depth and width of his character.
Right.
What I really like too about this whole story and the comics and everything is he makes everything bite-sized in a way that it's approachable.
Mm-hmm.
Like he makes concepts very, very easy to digest while there's still depth there for you to think about it, which I really appreciate because he respects his audience and saying that you're smart enough to figure this out, but at the same time, you know, here's everything right here, and he does a good job of this because it really, you feel everything. Like, right. The first time I read this, I read it in high school as a school thing because they were like, we're gonna do something cool, we're gonna be the cool class, and we're gonna do this this graphic novel, and they didn't tell us it was about the Holocaust, of course, so, you know, everybody's getting all excited for it, and then fucking, like, just the 2 weeks that we spent on that, and then the week after for testing and crap, because they tested the crap out of us for some reason. Just everybody was just depressed in that class. Like, nobody wanted to go to that class. It was just really dark, brutal stuff, man. You know?
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, it was also just, it really tells the story really well.
Yeah, it's between the two books. What's the page count on the books? Do we know?
Oh, I mean, God, not off the top of my head. It's
about 300 and, 18.
Actually, I do have a page count handy.
296.
296, yep.
Okay, and that's 296 pages. It sounds like a lot, and it is, but
it's very dense, though.
Right, right. The story he manages to tell in those 300 pages is rich.
Well, yeah, it's always about, like, it's one of those stories where, as you're reading it, you kind of get lost in it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't think about, like, oh, I just read a, you know, 300-page book, you know, without even thinking about it, you know? So, I've done that with, like, Watchmen and things like that. You just get into it, and you don't, the world kind of shuts down, and you're done all of a sudden, you know? So.
Right. It definitely holds your attention.
You just want to go to the, like, next page kind of thing, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I find myself, you know, I have a kind of a short attention span sometimes, so I'll find myself, like, you know, reading a few pages, flipping away to something else, and then just immediately coming back, you know, and pages. Because, like, you know, whereas if it was something else, I could easily, you know, read a few pages, go do something else, and never come back to it, you know. So it's kind of a testament to the book's quality that when my ADD does kick in, I'm immediately coming back to it, you know. It's very fascinating. And I regret I didn't actually get to finish the book before we did this episode tonight. And yet, as soon as we're done here, I'm probably going to go pick up where I left off and finish it, because it's great. It's worth a read, regardless of, you know. I mean, if whether you've got a fascination, you know, in what happened, you know, back during the Holocaust and, you know, shortly prior to it and whatnot, or you just like a good story, it's well worth the read, I think.
Yeah, definitely take time to read this if you're listening out there right now to this episode, because I did it for school and I didn't think I would want to read it again. I've read it like at least 4 times now, just overall in my lifetime, and every time I read it, it's always great. It's sad and it makes you feel things. Yeah, that's true, but it's just such a great piece of work, and it I don't know, I really like it.
It's definitely a fascinating kind of footnote in one person's, you know, experience, or it of, you know, his historical experiences and stuff.
And I think this is one of those stories that, like, kind of like when you go back, some of the classics, you go back and you find something in it that you didn't notice before. You know, it's like one of those little, how do you say it, nuances?
Right.
Yeah. It's a very nuanced thing, definitely.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, oh, I did this, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's another thing, you know? So.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. And the density of art and story, there's definitely, you know, plenty of room to find stuff that you kind of first time around.
Right.
Now, what's interesting, and it's of note because how Spiegelman brought it up, his mother, not only how neurotic, nervous, clingy his mother was, he felt really close to her. And her suicide deeply affected him.
Oh, yeah,
and deeply affected his father. One of the little plot lines running in the first book is that Vladek Spiegelman has a collection of Art's mother's diaries written about the Holocaust. But after her suicide, Vladek had destroyed them. And Art likens it to killing her all over again. I mean, not only would it have been a second angle of the Holocaust story he wanted to tell, it was also one of the last, you know, vestiges of his mother's, you know, thoughts left. And you kind of get the feeling that it's going to drive a wedge between them. But then, that, you know, the second...
That said, I can yeah, totally understand the father's point of view, considering,
yeah,
that...
it's more...
That's... That what those journals represented was basically not the woman that he married, not the woman he fell in love with, not the woman that he lost. It represented that what was taken away from her. It represented everything that the Germans did to him, or did to her, did to in his wife, And it just, I could totally understand why he would destroy them, because that's one more tool that the that has gone to the abyss. And yeah. Now it's just, but at the same time, it was there. It happened. It needed to be known. Her point of view needed to be seen. And it would certainly have helped Art in the long run to understand what happened and what drove his mother to suicide. So, there's that.
I think you completely just nailed it right there. I mean, that's... His mother's story was silenced, but at the same time, it's kind of, in death, the Nazis don't have her anymore.
Right.
So that was an interesting kind of subplot to read through. Now, what really makes this so fucking hard to read is what the Germans and the Poles do to the Jews. It's not just you're not given the overall textbook stuff that we're taught in high school, like, oh, they rounded them up into ghettos and then sent them to the ovens. This was the deep, dark stuff they did, the hangings. And I'm not talking like public executions, I'm talking straight up lynching in the street. To the beatings, to selling each other out. It makes it very personal, very dark, and hard to read. But at the same time, it makes you realize that what we're taught in schools and colleges about the Holocaust isn't the real horror. The real horror is how we stripped away our own humanity. I mean, if that makes any sense at all.
No, it does. It does.
Well, that's why he turns the characters into animals, I think, is because he wants to show them that they were treated like creatures, like animals, like they could be sorted as opposed to being unique beings, which is really what I like about the character design.
So kind of building on the Animal Farm idea of all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. All the mice are equal, but these ones sell each other out, so they're going to get preferential treatment.
And I like how you mentioned that, because it seems to me like we've all experienced kind of the human atrocities, you know, the killings and, you know, and whatnot through various media and you know, depictions of this one. Definitely, it puts a fine point on how this kind of tragedy, how this kind of thing can shape certain people. Monsters out of even the best of us.
Yeah.
You know, which is really fascinating. I mean, this book doesn't shy away from anything. It tells the story, you know, that Art's father set out to tell and pulls no punches. And I admire that.
Yeah, it took balls to make this. I mean, no two ways about it.
Not pussyfooting around anything. It's not saying, like, oh, the victims were, you know, all uniformly great people, and you know, it shows that, you know, that when in bad situations, good people to do bad things to one,
and bad people become worse.
Right.
What else is like interesting about that is they do at points take time to point out not all the Germans were bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, uniformly, they're well, let's be honest, they're dicks. But every now and then in the story, you'll see one that is at least human to the Jews. And I think that sits as a good counterpoint to most of the Jews tend to be, you know, at least decent people, but there's still a couple assholes in there. So it's not like everything is painted with a broad stroke, which is great.
Not black and white.
Yeah.
I mean, in a very literal sense, yeah, the art is black and white, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, the story, the tale told is not black and white. And that's the great thing. You know, it's... The story he's not telling... I mean, his father must have been a really straightforward, honest man too, because you know, these convictions aren't coming from nowhere, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, for his dad to recognize that in the midst of everything he went through is a pretty strong thing as well. His dad is thrust into the middle of this nightmare situation and yet recognize that, you know, not everyone on the other side of the issues was, you know, plenty of people were, but
yeah,
not everybody. That's kind of interesting right there.
Now, another thing that was interesting is Art does get his father to draw several sketches over the course of these interviews. And there are things like different methods of how the Jews would hide themselves from the Gestapo. Through, like, false bottoms, false walls, false coal bins, stuff like that. But you get to see a visual idea of how these mechanisms worked, you know? And then when Auschwitz and Birkenau are brought in to the narrative, maps are drawn out for you to see, you know, here's where the camp sat, here's where the other camp sat, see the relative sizes, like almost like the diagrams we were shown in high school, you know? And then they show later on a layout of the showers and crematoriums. Which, when I saw it, I couldn't help but think one thing. It is brutally efficient. I mean, they practically turned murder into a conveyor belt.
Terrifying.
It is. I mean, and then convince the people, oh, you're just going to go get a shower. I was like, okay, I'm going to go get a shower. Suddenly, you're getting gassed, and people are trying to, you know, claw their way through the door and getting mangled and mauled by other people trying to escape. And you just sit there and read this and going, it's brutal, it's inhuman, but holy shit, is it efficient. And that's a scary thought.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely a book where, like, if the Schindler's List kind of so uncomfortable.
True story, I will never watch Schindler's List again. I've only watched it once in my life, and I will never watch it again. It was too much.
That was enough for me. Yeah, funny enough, they made us watch it in high school.
Sam here?
Yeah. We had to sign a release and everything.
Sign a waiver.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. We had to sign.
Yeah, that was the same in my high school, too, when they wanted to show Schindler's List. They had to get the parents to sign a note saying, you know, they're okay to see this kind of thing.
Well, and it was, you know, being an R-rated movie and all that with the violence and the...
Little did they know I'd already seen it in my own house, but...
Right.
Up in Canada, the situation is different.
Really? How'd they work it up there?
They just showed us it.
Really? It was like, fuck you can take this.
Yes.
This will toughen them up.
Bill's character.
The only thing they did do was trying to censor the more... I don't know how to put this. The nude parts where they were, all the women were running from fucking the trains.
Right. Yeah.
But that's about as far as they did.
Now, see, we didn't have any of it, like, altered or censored.
That was uncomfortable to watch with a bunch of teenagers, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There was this one girl in my high school class who ended up leaving the room crying because we didn't know that she was Jewish, and it was just really awkward.
Right.
Like, it was the most awkward thing ever to have to be like, well, we're sorry we're watching a movie about, like, what happened to your granddad and stuff. Sorry.
But at the same time, part of me would just be like, shouldn't you have warned us that at the beginning?
Right. Well, yeah, and I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
That's what they did with us. They made it very clear to us that there were a lot of, you know, heavy themes and stuff in the movie, and that it didn't pull any punches. And you know, bringing it back to the book, the book is very much the same in that it doesn't pull any punches. doesn't treat you, you know, it doesn't treat the subject matter or the reader.
And there's even casual nudity.
Right. Which makes every book better. No.
Except for the fact that it's not women, it's men.
Right, right. But, well, you know, it's it's a very, very mature handling of the subject matter, you know, and it's just crazy when contrasted by the art. You know, you see these atrocities happening, and they're happening to, you know, anthropomorphic mice and whatnot, and it's kind of crazy to kind of wrap your head around that. But at the same time, you know, it almost makes it a little easier to kind of process.
In a way, it almost detaches from what's going on.
Right.
So you just don't focus on the horrific side of it, you focus on the character side of it.
Right. Which, you know, depending on what you're looking for, you know, can be a criticism or a... I mean, I think
it helped.
It's really I don't know. All I can say is, you know, and I recommend it. Worth reading at least one. If you haven't. It's a book that you don't... You know, people like to throw around the word experience a lot, you know. Oh, it's an experience. It's once-in-a-lifetime experience. I kind of feel like that applies to this book. You know, it is...
Unironically.
Unironically, yeah. It is an experience.
Definitely don't read this one if you have, you know, a history of depression issues, though. So, I mean, this book is many things, but it should not be what drives you over the edge.
Right.
And it definitely has the potential to do that.
Oh, absolutely. The, you know, like we were saying earlier, the way it handles the subject material is not, doesn't pussyfoot around it. So, you go into it knowing that if your depression, this is going to exacerbate the problem.
Now, there was a line from this comic that I think you were mentioning to me earlier, Daryl. There might have been Dick.
Yeah, it was most probably Dick.
A line about maybe they just need a bigger Holocaust.
Yeah, it was the fucking his dad said to his son. He was talking about it. I'm bad with character names, so I apologize.
Yeah.
He said maybe they need a bigger Holocaust for some reason. I don't remember what the context was, but oh, because people don't remember the Holocaust and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, they
basically
should.
Yeah, saying that it was going back the same kind of way. Which
kind of like it's kind of like that whole, you know, if you don't remember history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
It's something, you know, even I think about every now and then. It's like, we have ethnic cleansing all the damn time. You know, let's admit it. The world has never gotten rid of the idea of genocide. But none of it ever seems to stick in our minds. Normally because it's, you know, some third world country with one of their minorities, you know?
But it's like, you know,
or
who talks about the Armenian genocide?
Right.
System of a Down, and that's about it.
What? Yeah, but still, how long did it take for, like, our government to even recognize the Armenian genocide?
Oh, right. God.
Who speaks of the Rwanda genocide?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's recent year. I mean, that's recent years. That was, like, you know, not too long ago, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
The reason we know about the Holocaust and we talk about it is because it was surrounded by a great war.
Right.
You know, and if not for that, would we have, if the Nazis hadn't started the war, would we have talked about it?
I don't know.
I mean, it's something to think about, you know?
I imagine that given the sheer number of people, know, killed in the thing, it's one of those.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, no, because I'm with you in the sense that I don't, part of me wants to think that the numbers would have people talking, but at the same time, I can't really say that with any confidence.
Right, because the Arminians, what was that, like 3 million?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, you see, I had this conversation where it was about money, but, you know, you still got to look at it. 1 million is a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think about it, you know, and like I was talking, you know, saying the other day, we think about it in monetary gain things. It's like, oh, people throw around billion, trillion, no big deal. No, a million is a lot. So a million dead people is a lot. 3 million dead people is a whole lot. 6 million dead people is a hell of a whole lot.
Right.
You know, so like you said, you know, you're hoping that just by the sheer volume that people right. would still talk about it. But would we have, and like we said, you know, like I said, we're getting into the history a little bit here, but would the war have been won without the United States coming in and, like, you know, actually getting involved in it? Because we were, you know, very isolationist at that point.
Yep.
So if the Americans hadn't gotten involved at all, and then, like, we just kind of let, you know, the Nazis take over Europe, and, you know, let's pretend like it just existed to this day, and we ended up in, like, a Cold War situation, would there be a Jewish race? You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to, you know, it's always about, like, different, you got to, like, what ifs in situations right. like that. I mean, I've heard, you know, what if Lincoln had lived, like, he might have became a tyrant.
He would have continued fighting vampires.
Well, yeah. But I'm just saying, you know, it's a possibility he could have became a tyrant. You know, he right. could have became King Lincoln. You know, we don't know. Nobody
okay,
knows.
Okay, now you're just getting into Assassin's Creed territory.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, you know, why yeah. do we talk, like I said, we talk about the Holocaust because it's surrounded by a huge historical event, which was World War II.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of those who were involved. And we call, you know, we could say it, but, you know, it's all true that, you know, history is written by the victors, you know?
Well, yeah, it's usually the losers are dead.
Well, yeah. This is, you know, very true.
Lincoln is talked of as a hero, but he was one of the few presidents to suspend habeas corpus. Now, imagine what would happen if he had suspended it indefinitely.
See, this is why we bring Mike along.
9/11 would have been a lot less messy, I'll tell you that.
Oh, God. Oh, bless America.
No.
And this is where we walk it back and talk about the comics more.
Yes, exactly. Well, we're running up against the last 5 minutes of our show here.
Well, we got a little more than that, actually. We started late.
Oh, did we start late? Okay, yep. Well, there you go. So
we actually got about 12 minutes.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. You know what? We've been talking some doom and gloom. Let's talk about something a little upbeat for a few.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. Anybody been reading anything other than Mouse?
No. I did read one of the new X-Men issues where they showed off the new Horseman.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Well,
wait.
Please do tell us, because I'm yes. very interested in hearing this. Go ahead.
Well, okay, well, do you want me to give you kind of a quick primer of the story, or do you want me just to...
Can I take a wild guess that it has something to do with Apocalypse?
Only sort of.
Travel.
Okay, time
well,
travel.
Here's
apocalypse.
The thing.
Got it.
It's only an implied Apocalypse.
Right. Okay.
Right. But, okay, so long story short, the Four Horsemen... are Peter, you know, Colossus, Moon Knight, a new female new Moon Knight, who else was it? Deadpool, and yep. I forget who the fourth one was all of a sudden.
Is Deadpool at least Pestilence? Because that makes the most sense.
The other one was Venom.
Yeah, or a symbiote, yeah. Yeah, we weren't sure if it was Venom or just a symbiote or what, but yeah,
that's
right.
They have not laid out who is who, with one exception. They heavily imply that Peter is Death.
Yeah.
Because he's in the lead.
Right. As, you know, like, to me, my horseman.
Yeah.
And then the issue ends.
Now, Wayne, here's what's funny. Oh, I'm sorry, I just pulled up the wiki entry.
Yeah?
They're calling Peter Apocalypse.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, because the way he was talking was very suggestive of not just a leadership in the death role, but, like, as the horsemen were his, you know? And that's, so he...
Yeah, I need to actually read that issue.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's saying to me, my horseman kind of implies...
right. Leadership of the horsemen.
Implies through the big A.
Yeah, yeah, so... Okay, what? So you're talking about time travel and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to
wrap
my head around.
1,000 years into the future.
Okay, so we're 1,000 years in the future, and somehow Pyotr Rasputin is still alive.
No, he gets sucked into the future.
Okay.
There's this machine, and yeah, it sends
him
1,000 years
man.
Into the future. Yeah, because of the Sugar Man. They run against the Sugar Man and fight him, and then his machine goes off and sends Peter... 1,000 years and a few of the other X-Men 1,000 years into the future, and where he becomes now apparently Deadpool is still alive by that point, but is anybody surprised?
Well, he's kind of got that perpetual might not be able to die thing.
exactly. So it's a time travel thing, and I don't get it yet. I don't know where they're going. Oh, and it was all headed off. They went to, the reason they went up against the Sugar Man is because they found, you know, the Terrigen Mists keep mutants from being born.
Mpox.
Yeah. Yet they figured out they found a signature with 600 new mutants, and it was basically Sugar Man doing his genetic manipulation thing, and so it wasn't really like mutant. That sense, but that's what brought him to him and what kicked off the whole thing with Peter going into the future and showing up as either Apocalypse or a horseman. But that issue's new, so we got a little while to figure out what the fuck's going on.
Yeah, I think the next one's slated to come out like the 20th of next month.
Well, since we're talking about the horseman, if you had to do your top 10, like, or should I say your top 4 horsemen, like, of all the horsemen that have ever, you know, been a horseman.
Let's make this interesting. You have to pick them not as their character, but as their role.
Right.
So you can only have one of each.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Of all the ones who have been horsemen, who would you pick as a horseman?
Oh, God.
As your A-team of horsemen, I guess you could say. I can already tell you, War, the Hulk.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't.
Because he had the best fucking line I have ever heard said to Juggernaut. Because they were fighting, right? They brought in like this group called the New World Order brought in Juggernaut to fight War Hulk, right?
Yeah.
Who, you know? Okay, we're talking about a Hulk who's been augmented by Apocalypse at this point, right?
Yeah.
And they're going back and forth, and like Juggernaut said something to the effect of, you know, usually you're going on about how you're the strongest one there is. Maybe you finally realize it's not true. And then the Hulk knocks his helmet off, points his sword at his throat, and he said, nope, it's because it's so obvious.
It's too obvious. Everyone knows.
definitely say War is my, for Hulk. So. All right,
I got this laid out for you. Death, Angel.
Yep.
War, Hulk. Famine, Sunfire. Pestilence, Caliban.
Yes.
Now, see, I'm mostly familiar with the original lineup of horsemen. So, I mean, I know Wolverine at one point became Death, right?
Yeah, he did.
Or was it a Skrull?
No,
the Skrull was Wolverine.
The Skrull was Wolverine.
Death
and
was,
then,
yeah. Wolverine yeah. became Death while the Skrull was.
And he kind of came out better in the deal because, like, you know, Apocalypse was like, hey, fam, you need your adamantium back? All right, here you go.
Yep. And see, but that's – so I'm not too familiar with the, like, the latter-day incarnations of the
Well,
horsemen.
Some of them – Caliban was a horseman for a while. And like,
he
was different roles. He was, like, Pestilence, and at one point he was Death.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but Caliban kind of, like, you know, flirted around being a horseman a few times. Sunfire, I think he was one of those quick hits, too.
He was when Gambit and Polaris and Gazer.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Hmm?
And then, of course, there was a time that Cyclops was the host for Apocalypse.
Right. So. Right, right. I do recall that.
That was, during,
during the 12, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Psylocke has been deaf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah.
Now, not to change the subject, but have you guys seen the new X-Men Apocalypse trailer?
Yes, I have. And it pisses me off.
Really? Really? Why? Do tell.
Well, yeah. It pisses me off not because it's not. It's okay. I'm not saying it's bad.
Sure.
But Psylocke's psychic blade immaterial. It is cannot cut through solid objects. That is bullshit.
Oh yeah, it's a psychic blade. It affects your psyche, not your. Giant.
I was like, "Fuck you, Bryan Singer, for wanting some cool ass shit looking ninja flippy shit."
But hey, I mean, as bad as it seems, hey, at least we got a psychic blade toting.
An actual Psylocke.
Yeah.
Not like the one they tried to pull on us in
X-Men
3. Yeah. It's like, what did they make her, like, just gave her super speed or some stupid shit?
Yeah, yeah. No, like, she could teleport in the shadows or something.
Oh,
like,
she had the Crimson Dawn powers. That was
it. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was.
Yeah, really, she didn't have her psychic abilities or anything like that.
Really dumb. But, no, so what did you think? I mean, look, now, I don't know where they're going to go with the continuity because of, you know, because if Deadpool is in continuity, then that suggests that, you know, Apocalypse loses. Yet, in the trailer, there's some pretty widespread fucking destruction. So, I'm thinking, I'm hoping, I mean, this would be ballsy if they did a new trilogy, you know, following this and have it fucking X-Men, you know, have it Age of Apocalypse and shit. Where, like, you know, like, fucking, ugh, I don't know. Just,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's where please? I want them to go. In reality, they're not going to go there.
No, because it's, you know, not safe.
But I mean, if you've seen the trailer, like, there's widespread, and it's not just one city. It looks like Apocalypse has taken out cities worldwide. Like, there's huge destruction everywhere.
That actually makes sense, because in the comics,
mm-hmm.
even at his first appearance in the X-Factor,
right,
it was always implied that he was never at his full strength.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't know how, you know, they're probably not going to hit up too much because it's, you know, Fox, and Fox is limited on kind of what they're all, you know, they're only allowed mutant stuff, so they can't, like, dip into too much other things.
They
but
can't have them be celestially powered.
Well, right. See, there's you know, kind of rumors going around that it might not be addressed as such, but that he is going to be integrating alien power.
Yeah,
or alien technology.
Yeah, the alien tech. Yeah, but right. they won't say celestial tech.
Right.
You know, it'll just say
probably not
alien tech. But like,
well,
you know,
what would the celestials fall under? Would that be Fantastic Four or just regular Marvel?
They're just regular Marvel, more than likely, because they're kind of ambivalent. They're kind of like the Cedars of the universe.
Right. Well, yeah,
they'll
yeah.
show up everywhere.
Yeah, and
oh, you know what though? With the rumor that Eternity was in Ant-Man, it would seem like those would fall under Marvel's purveyance, you know?
Yeah, they'll fall under. In fact, one of the if like you look at
is anybody proven that to be true?
Not yet, because the silhouette that I've seen could be Eternity or it could be Janet. So, you know, it's very mm-hmm. vague on who and what it could be.
Well, don't they? I gotta ask because God, it's been a little while since I've seen the movie.
Sure.
In Guardians of the Galaxy, did they have Nowhere in there?
Yes. Yeah.
And it was the celestial head.
That's
yeah,
right.
So that,
that's
so
right.
that confirms that even, celestials.
Yes, and yeah. they even straight out referred to yep. it as the severed head of a celestial.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. So that's Marvel. Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that won't be happening in X-Men.
Yeah, no. I'm looking at this supposed image of Eternity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing Jan.
Yeah, it looks like her with her wings out, right? Kind of
yeah.
coming towards the camera with her arms out and her wings up, you know?
Yeah.
And see, that's the thing, you know? It's very... And it makes sense in the context of the story. It would make more sense for that to be Janet than Eternity, even though the Quantum Realm apparently is going to be kind of like where they play with that stuff. And apparently they're going to be making a return trip to there in Doctor Strange. So
well, apparently they can't use the Microverse because they lost the rights.
Right, right. Yeah,
so,
they never really owned them, didn't they? Weren't they just kind of, wasn't it a licensing thing that they were doing
I
back in the day
so.
With the Micronauts and all that?
Yeah.
They never really owned it, but...
But they still kept using them off and on in comics.
This is true. Was Micronauts the one with the bug guy?
Yeah, Bug became a Guardian of the Galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
It was recent they lost the Micronauts.
Well, you know, they've got ways around it. And this is what I'm liking about Marvel is that when they run up against these roadblocks, they
found a good way around it.
Right, right. Like a man who's just had a stroke, they reroute their synapses and stuff.
Well, it's kind of like what they did about the mutant problem. You know, they don't have mutants, they have inhumans.
Exactly.
You know,
they fill the same function, essentially. Yeah. But, you know, they're just inhumans.
Really. Well, folks, it's that time.
All right.
It's time we say our goodbyes for the night. Yeah. This has been Back Issues. I'm Jason.
Daryl.
Dick.
Wayne.
And special guest Mike.
That's
going to be it. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us.